You're listening to America's Most Challenging Issue, where Baha'iTeachings.org interviews community builders across the nation who are inspired by the Baha'i vision of the oneness of humankind. Join us as we explore their work, bringing about racial unity and establishing a more just and equitable society. I'm your host, Masoud Olufani. Justice is not limited. It is a universal quality. Its operation must be carried out in all classes, from the highest to the lowest. Justice must be sacred, and the rights of all the people must be considered. Desire for others only that which you desire for yourselves. Then shall we rejoice in the sun of justice, which shines from the horizon of God. From the Baha'i Writings. Cynthia Barnes Slater is a warrior for justice. Born and raised in San Francisco, California, she earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in government from Cornell University. A retired human resources professional with 30 years experience specializing in employee relations and diversity, she has consistently sought to foster spaces of inclusion in both the public and private sector. She is a mother of two adult sons and a grandmother, who embraced the Baha'i faith in 1974 after initially investigating the faith at 16. Her subsequent services as a Baha'i have led her to extended periods in Togo, West Africa, London, England, and Oakland, California. Currently, she serves as a volunteer for the Baha'i House of Worship in Wilmette, Illinois, and for Books and Breakfasts, a community-based program that provides healthy breakfasts and assistance with schoolwork for children in Evanston, Illinois. She's also served as a member of the Race Advisory Council for Baha'i Teachings, the nonprofit entity that produces this podcast. In addition to all that, she has been and remains a dear friend. Cynthia Barnes Slater, welcome to America's Most Challenging Issue.
Thank you, Masoud. Wow, thank you for that introduction.
Well, why don't we, it's so good to have you here. And, without keeping people in further suspense, why don't we jump right in? Does that sound good?
Sure, it sounds great.
You know, I've been fortunate enough to work with you as co-members of the Race Advisory Council for Baha'iTeachings.org. And one of the things I've always, known about you is that you have this passionate, you're a passionate, articulate proponent of diversity, in particular when it comes to the, underrepresentation of marginalized groups, right? And I'm wondering where that fire comes from in you and how it's shaped and driven by the Baha'i principle of unity and diversity.
Well, I grew up, as you know, I grew up in San Francisco, California. I was born there and really spent most of my formative years there till I went to college. I grew up around not only African-American people, but Chinese, Mexican-American, Filipino people. And, in fact, my parents met in Chinatown. And we used to go to Chinatown a lot. San Francisco at that time had a lot of distinct neighborhoods that, because it's such a small city, you could, go one place and hear Tagalog and another place and hear Mandarin, and Spanish, of course, was prevalent everywhere. For me, when I went to school in high school, my high school was actually, I went to Lowell High School in San Francisco, which was right next to San Francisco State. And if you're familiar with the history of the 60s, San Francisco State was really kind of the hotbed of student activism, especially with starting an ethnic studies department. So at that time, 1968, I was 16. I ran for president, class president, on a third world ticket. Me and another Chinese guy decided we want, and we were in the minority in the high school. It was predominantly white college prep high school.
But
we decided to run on a third world ticket, which had never been done before. And we won. We both won. I was class president. He was vice president. And then we had the prom that year in Chinatown, which it all had that also had never been done before. And a lot of the white people were scared to go to Chinatown because they said it was too dangerous. But some of the best Black R&B dance clubs were in Chinatown at the time in San Francisco. So I really got my activism really at a young age. And then when I went to college, of course, I went to Cornell the year after the Willard Strait takeover, which is, there's a famous picture of Black students coming out of the student hall with guns. And I entered Cornell the year after that happened. So, you know, my passion for diversity, for, you know, understanding who I was as a person of African descent really started early. My parents were college educated. My grandmother was a business owner. Both my parents were my mother and grandmother were business owners in San Francisco. They were active in the NAACP and the, you know, from their church, and they had all were part of the Great Migration that left the South and moved to the North, and in this case, San Francisco. So I feel like I really had a deep understanding growing up in that environment of, you know, the true history of this country and how it has marginalized people, it has devalued people, but also I had a sense of my own worth. And my parents weren't like, they weren't anti-white, they were just pro-Black.
And I wanted to find out how, you talked about this very rich, diverse upbringing, which almost made you tailor-made to hear about the Baha'i faith, right?
Yes.
And I was just wondering how, you know, this passion for justice for marginalized communities was impacted, by the Baha'i principle of unity and diversity. How do you see it?
Well, when I've heard about the faith when I was 16, and I was I went to a church camp, United Church of Christ camp in California, in Calistoga, Cazadero. And one of my friends, she was white, and she invited me to come to a Baha'i fireside in San Francisco. And at the time, I was...
What's a fireside?
A Baha'i fireside is an informal gathering in someone's home where the writings of Baha'u'llah, the prophet founder of the Baha'i faith, are read and discussed, and questions are asked and answered. And it was just, it was great. I got to meet people. I was young. Excuse me. So there were people from Asia, people from Africa, other African Americans, young, old, Latino. And I just thought, wow, we all love God. We're all talking about, you know, spiritual principles and ideas. And there's no, the thing that I really liked was there was no clergy. There was no, someone saying, well, I know, and everybody else doesn't know. There didn't seem to be that spiritual hierarchy. But I continued to read about the faith, but I went on my own path when I went to college. But when I came back, I came back from school and I graduated from school. And mainly it was because this idea that unity and diversity, that we come from different paths, but we can all be part of the same human family. The Baha'u'llah said, compared us to the flowers of a garden. You know, that really, it had a very strong impact for me, because while I, you know, was happy, I'm clear of my identity as an African-American, I didn't want to become a separatist. I didn't want to become part of like an all-Black community or, you know, and then I definitely didn't want to be part of an all-white community. I was curious about, I speak French, I spoke Spanish. I wanted to know about different cultures and different ideas. And so the Baha'i faith seemed really just, I believe in God. I believed in, you know, the oneness of God, the oneness of his prophets. I knew I could still believe in Jesus and be a Baha'i. So, it was just a perfect fit for me.
As you're talking about your experience in San Francisco and, you know, kind of interfacing with these other communities, it sounds like in many ways you were prepared in a sense, like the notion of unity and diversity was not really a huge stretch for you. For some people it is, it's a big challenge, but it sounds like from your experience, it really was almost a fulfillment of what you had experienced growing up in a way.
Right.
That's wonderful. Well, you know, You know, we all, as the Baha'i Faith talks about this notion of unity and diversity, about people maintaining their unique, you know, cultural identity, while at the same time recognizing that we are one. And I'm thinking about specific challenges that particular communities face. And one of the things, you know, one of the questions that I'm always interested in asking Black mothers, you know, who have raised Black sons within a society that often devalues and criminalizes the Black body, right, is what practices of creative resilience have been instrumental in that process? And, you know, more specifically for you as a Black woman, you know, informed by the very specific teachings on the spiritual distinction of people of African descent within the Baha'i writings, how did those teachings serve you in successfully navigating this extremely challenging task of raising Black boys?
Well, for me, it was really totally immersing myself in the Word of God, in the Word of Baha'u'llah. I must have at least 50 prayer books that I've collected over the years. And I've memorized several prayers by heart. But more importantly, I really tried to instill in my children this concept. Baha'u'llah says that we are created noble. Every human being is created noble. Noble have I created thee. And I tried to remind and reinforce my children in my children that they were noble, that I saw the good in them, and that they could stand up on their holy ground as their authentic selves, who they were. I didn't mitigate the fact that they were going to be seen as Black, even though their father is white. They, you know, are Black children for all intents and purposes. And that this unique nobility had to do with their humanness, not the color of their skin. I wanted them to know, even though they were both born in London, England, I wanted them to know their African ancestry. And so we moved back to the United States when my oldest son was 8 and my youngest was 18 months. Now today, they're very thankful that we moved back. They think that they would have been different children. At least my oldest son says this all the time, if they had grown up in England. I exposed them to the other concept. Baha'u'llah has said that he compared us to the pupil of the eye, that we are the part of the eye that shows everything that's in front of it. And so I wanted them to ask questions. I wanted them to see the dichotomies or the, you know, the contrast, look, that some of their white friends could do things that they couldn't do, or that they would get treated differently. But I wanted them to not internalize that difference, just as my parents didn't internalize the differences that they knew I would experience. They wanted me to be well-educated, which is what I wanted for my children, to be articulate, to be able to think critically, to be able to be independent, to, you know, to know that they come from somebody and somebody loves them, and that they have love not just from their American, African-American family, but also from their British family. And so that was really hard. I mean, it was hard work. And I don't think it's all done, but I just got back from New York, so I was around both of them. And I really am very proud of who they are as adults now. And, I memorized prayers with them. The other thing that a lot of people don't know is their middle names. Sean's middle name is Gregory, and Zachary's middle name is Lewis. And Lewis Gregory was a very prominent African-American Baha'i who met Abdu'l-Bahá, the son of Baha'u'llah. And at a time when racial segregation was just virulent and Jim Crow was enforced, Lewis Gregory actually came to a Baha'i meeting and there was no place for him to sit. It was a segregated meeting in Washington, D.C. And Abdu'l-Bahá stood up and went to him and brought him and sat him right next to him at the place of honor to demonstrate that this was a new day, that race unity you know, was something that wasn't theoretical. It was actually something that he himself as the center of the covenant of Baha'u'llah practiced, but also expected everybody else who believed in him to practice. And so one of the reasons why I wanted to name my children, give my children Lewis Gregory's name is for that reason, is that, you know, this is inevitable that we're going to have race unity, that we will be one, but it's a process, you know, it's a learning process. And so, you know, I've tried my best to instill in them this sense of who they come. I also used to read African folk tales to them. In the African community, you know, we have this, when I lived in Africa, there were stories of griots. The griot is the storyteller, like the town crier that tells the story of the ancestors and tells what's going on in the community. Well, I really wanted them to understand some of the, what people call mother wit, which is what African, you know, African, like, don't argue with a lion when your head is in its mouth, and you know, certain
wise advice.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted them to understand the genesis of what I learned from my grandmother, from my parents. These ways of getting, you know, a lot of ways getting over as a Black person that it's passed down from person to person. And a lot of them are, you know, from tribal tales from the Congo, from Senegal, from Cameroon, different parts of West Africa. So I used to read those books to them. They were dog-eared and they loved it. I read them over and over and over again. And so now they have this baseline of kind of understanding how the world works in a way that is just innate. You know, so, and of course, they were both raised, I mean, they both were around when my parents were still alive. So they learned a lot from them as well.
It's wonderful. Wow. I remember when I first became a Baha'i, it was before, when I was investigating the faith at Morehouse College, and I first read that teaching about people of African descent being as the pupil of the eye, and how empowering that was, because here you had a manifestation of God saying that, speaking specifically, right, to a cultural group that has had, such as the Baha'i writings say, such long healing wounds, and empowering us with the language, with the prophetic language, with the language of revelation. So I found that to be incredibly comforting and incredibly empowering for me. So, man, thank you so much. There was so much wonderful information in your response. I really appreciate that. Wonderful. But, you know, the focus of this podcast is highlighting the creative ways members of the American Baha'i community are working to rid the nation of the cancer of racism, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about this current plan of action for the Baha'i world community that focuses on strengthening the spiritual and material well-being of our neighborhoods through a series of community building activities like children's classes, devotional gatherings, junior youth empowerment programs, and study of the sacred writings. And I'm wondering, what impact do you think these practices will have on the issue of race in America?
Well, I think, I've thought a lot about it because I've been involved in the community building process definitely in the last 20 years, and that the process, the framework for action involves these core activities, children's classes, junior youth groups, devotional gatherings and study circles. I think they will have a profound effect in breaking down barriers of ignorance regarding the true nature of who we are as individuals and collectively within our neighborhoods. Baha'u'llah, one of his principles is, he says that truthfulness is the foundation of all human virtues. So if we're trying to practice the virtue of learning, you know, to become spiritually closer to people, to be friendlier, to be, to be a resource for people, solace for people, then it has to be from a framework of truthfulness. And to the extent that we're able to demonstrate this truthfulness in word and deed, this message of oneness and of justice, understanding, because, you know, you can't have truthfulness with injustice. You can't have truthfulness with ignorance. You have to have truthfulness about where we are right now as a people. And so I think it's not dichotomous. It's actually something that can go hand in hand, working together as we raise our awareness. So in the community, in the neighborhood that I live in, there have been groups of people, both Baha'is and people who are not Baha'is, who are really interested in racial justice. And we formed a group called HEROES, Healing Everyday Racism in Our Schools. And from that group, we have really, some of the people of that group actually went to the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery and spent quite a bit of time learning about the history of not just slavery, but mass incarceration and domestic terrorism that happened in this country. And from that group, we've learned more about residential segregation, healthcare disparities, you know, so forth and so on, with the basis of race. Now, the interesting thing about this group is there's quite a few white people in the group who are now more activated to actually learn, you know, to educate other white people, but then also do nonviolent, non-political ways of making changes in, like, say, affordable housing or providing a better education, a curriculum, improving the curriculum for schools where they've had racial incidents. And mainly it's because people are ignorant of our true history. So you know, they're acting out from a standpoint of not really knowing the truth about this country. So I think that, and what a really interesting thing is that two of the people that went on this group have already attended two Baha'i devotional gatherings. They're not Baha'is, but they were so moved by a passage that was read from Shoghi Effendi, The Advent of Divine Justice, about what white people can do and what Black people could do to eliminate racism, that they actually came to another devotional gathering and are very interested in attending future devotional gatherings to talk about what we as Baha'is know and what we understand about how to achieve race unity. So it's a little different in the sense that we're trying to really build relationships from the ground up, I think, in this process. And these relationships cannot be superficial. They can't be one-off. They have to be consistent over time. We have to literally become like the fingers of one hand. But we're so united. And that takes time. It takes concentrated effort. But it also takes awareness. We have to be knowledgeable about the current dialogues, what the discourse of racial justice is happening in the United States today. And I think a lot of people are not really aware of what the level of the discourse is. At least this is my view in the Baha'i community. They're not necessarily, as the French would say, au courant about what the issues are. But I have a lot of hope that they, you know, that people will be, and that there's enough people who are not just writing, but they're reading. And they're forming, like, another interesting thing in our community here in Evanston, several Baha'is have been serving as volunteer facilitators for a racial justice book group, where we, you know, pick a book, like we picked White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo. And the whole community gets a chance to read it. The book is at the library. You don't have to buy it. You can download it, whatever. And over 180 people turned up to discuss that book in the Evanston community. And quite a few, I'd say like 10% of them were Baha'is, but most of the people were white people in the community that wanted to talk about racial justice and about white supremacy and how to move the dialogue further. So there, and we're becoming known as Baha'is within the community as people who are champions of racial justice. And I think this is another way that we can move the community building process forward, but we can't be shy about it, and we can't be circumspect about it. We have to be fearless and upfront, and you know, and really have our focus on what the Guardian said, that the Guardian Khashoggi Effendi, who was the great grandson of Baha'u'llah, said that this was a patent evil in our country. Mm. And, you know, we have to be clear. In fact, I was really surprised when I read that quote from The Advent of Divine Justice and how this person who I went to Montgomery with just like lapped it up. I mean, he was just like, oh, I want to read the whole book now. And, you know, and a lot of Baha'is would never think of giving The Advent of Divine Justice to somebody to read who wasn't a Baha'i. That's my experience. So I think we just have to be audacious. And since I went to Montgomery, one of the things that I might have told you this since I've talked to you, that I'm not holding back anymore when it comes to the most vital and challenging issue facing the United States, which is eliminating racism, eliminating racial injustice. You know, my ancestors, I'm pointing to Miss Harriet Tubman there, that I have a picture of her in my home, who would introduce, that's a really nice, I have a really great story about that how I got that picture. But I just feel like our ancestors are calling to us, and they want us to, you know, because there is so much that we can do to speak on this issue and to act on this issue, not just to speak, but to
absolutely
act.
Absolutely. Wow. It's wonderful. A couple of things that you mentioned that I think are really important. This idea of gathering in spaces, you know, in neighborhoods, but it's not just a social gathering. So, you know, being social is part of it, right? Mm-hmm. But certainly the belief from the Baha'i standpoint is that those gatherings are charged by the word of God, by this kind of contemplation, reflection, and communal engagement with the word of God, which transforms the space just from a social gathering to something else, to a higher elevation. And then the other thing is this idea of intentional relationship building, right? Where, you know, we are consciously choosing to put ourselves in spaces where, you know, you might for the first time in your life experience being a minority.
Yes.
But that's important, right? In terms of really getting a grasp of empathy. You know, of really understanding, perhaps, in some sense, you won't fully be able to understand, but in some sense, the plight of marginalized groups and what they go through on a daily basis. So that notion of intentional relationship building across cultural lines, across ethnic lines, across social economic lines, being critical to the work. It's so important. Thank you. You know, we're both very aware that the core principle of the Baha'i faith is the oneness of mankind, right? We've talked a little bit about this, but the great destiny of humanity is the inevitable realization that we all descend from one divine source, right? And that our primary identity, not the only identity, but our primary identity is not racial or cultural, but it's spiritual. Now, the American Baha'i community is actively engaged in manifesting this transcendent teaching, making great strides and also experiencing our share of challenges like everyone else. And I'm wondering for you, as someone who is deeply invested in this work, facing your own share of joy and pain, what do you find in the teachings of Baha'u'llah that gives you the resilience to persevere?
Because I know that Baha'u'llah is my Lord, that he came for me. Mm. You know, I have a personal relationship with the manifestation of God. I pray every day, morning and eve. I meditate on the writings. I really feel very strong and confident in that, my belief in Baha'u'llah. So it doesn't, I mean, some of the things that affect some of my other brothers and sisters in the faith, that they get annoyed or they get frustrated or they get discouraged, don't necessarily affect me as much anymore, because I know who my Lord is. And I often, in fact, just last night, there were two African-American women that are interested in the faith, and they're really deepening, reading the writings, coming to firesides and devotional gatherings. And one of them said something, and she says, oh, I'm courting the Baha'i faith, and I really feel like this might be my community. And I said, well, it's really important, just, you know, as a warning to make sure that you are totally rooted in Baha'u'llah, the glory of God for this day, rooted in his word, in his life, his teachings, and that you are holding on, like one of the prayers, holding on to the hem of the rope. And that's, and anybody says, ask me how I'm doing, I always say, I'm holding on to the hem of the rope, which have clung all in this world and in the world to come. Yes. Because people will, you know, I mean, it's just like any organization or any group. You're going to have all kinds of different people, perspectives. You know, there's going to be people say things to you. They'll hurt your feelings. They'll make you mad. You'll, you know, or they'll ignore you, or, you know, there's all these things that can happen. But if you insulate your soul, your spirit with the love of Baha'u'llah and with his teachings, then it, all these things will just run off your back like duck off a duck's back. And then we'll still, you know, stay focused on, you know, serving the cause of God, serving your, you know, your fellow man, your human in humanity, and not let these things dissuade you. And we were taught, the reason why this came up is these women were talking about like being in their church and how some of the stuff that happens in the church is kind of really disconcerting. And I said, yeah, and I can understand that. I said, because that happened to me when I was, you know, when I was a child, I got basically kicked out of Sunday school because I asked too many questions. My mother thought it was really funny that my Sunday school teacher wanted me out of the class because I was, you know, she said I was disruptive, but I was asking questions because things didn't make sense. And so it's important that I knew that I loved Jesus. I knew I loved God. And so, you know, knowing that had carried me and helped me recognize Baha'u'llah. So I think that that's the most important thing to hold on to is Baha'u'llah has come for the whole world, for every human soul, wherever they are, in whatever continent, whatever island, whatever remote, and that it's Baha'u'llah is not the messenger of one particular country or one particular economic class or one particular race. Baha'u'llah is the manifestation of God for all humanity. And that includes me and you. So, you know, that's what I hold on to. That's the hem of the robe that I hold on to. And that gets me through some things that, you know, I mean, we're running out of time, but I've been basically, you know, buked and scorned, as the gospel song says, as a Baha'i within the Baha'i community.
Yeah.
You know, not really bad stuff, but just stuff that would just, you kind of go, what? But I always always just bring it back to Baha'u'llah and thinking about how he was treated by his own family. Closest to him, treated him like, you know, he wasn't anybody. And it's kind of astounding to me that's in the history of our faith. So
And consistent with the history of all the messengers of the great religious faith, right? So that treatment is not unusual to the Baha'i faith.
No, it isn't.
I'm so glad that you said what you said, because I think sometimes we can join religion, or we recognize a truth, but we may join a faith and treat it like a social club, right?
Yes.
Like it's like, okay, oh, I've got some friends here who believe what I believe, and you know, and we're all going to get along fabulously. It's just going to be wonderful. I'm not lonely in the world anymore with my thoughts or my ideas. And then, and because of that, because that is the source of the connection, when people do some of the things that we do, it's like leaving any other group. You're like, I can't deal with y'all. I'm out. You know, where the connection really should be ultimately is with the manifestation of God and with the truth that you found in that particular faith. So that's such an important point to keep in mind and to keep in one's heart. Well, you know, Cynthia, you know, we're just about out of time. This has been amazing. So good. And I'm so grateful to have had this time with you. But before we go, I wanted to ask you about hope. As you look at the world through the prism of the Baha'i faith, are you hopeful about the future? And if so, why?
Well, I am hopeful. I have been blessed in this last couple of years with two granddaughters. I'm a grandmother.
That's wonderful.
One was just born on my mother's birthday, which was a whole confirmation. And when I think of them and who, what kind of world I would like to leave them, you know, of course, I want them to be spiritually grounded in who they are as women, but as also spirits of you know, spiritual. And, you know, it's sometimes it's really difficult to have hope because people can be so mean and horrible. But I realized that this is just the part of the darkness before the dawn. You know, I hate to use that kind of cliche, but it really is. We're going through a process of disintegration towards integration, you know, and we are, it's simultaneous and it can be very disruptive. But I do have a lot of hope because I have a lot of hope in our youth, in our children, our infants, and being, now that I've reached the age of being an elder, which is hard for me to imagine, that I'm an elder, I'm trying to, you know, own my eldership and try to be a person that shows like there's light, you know, that there is hope, that God said it, you know, that, you know, love me that I may love thee. If thou lovest me not, my love can in no wise reach thee.
Know this, O servant. And the way that I have hope, the reason why I have hope, is that I know God's love is eternal. God's love is infinite. And no matter what we do, God still loves us as human beings. That it was from love that the manifestations, Jesus, Muhammad, were sent to humanity for our development, our education. And so by focusing, you know, it's hard. I mean, it's really hard to have love and forgiveness when somebody has their feet on your neck, okay? It's very hard to have love and forgiveness or love when you feel, you see the inequities and the disparities that exist because of skin color. It's very hard to have love and to be, but love is the secret of who we are as human beings. And if we can't love God, we can't love ourselves. And if we can't love ourselves, we can't love anybody else. So that's what I hope to, you know, I mean, I'm at the last quarter of my life. I'll be 67 in August. So I don't, you know, I'm not at the beginning, I'm at the end. So I have a perspective at the end of, you know, towards the end of my life of how I want to live the rest of my life and what I want to leave for my children and my grandchildren. So that this concept of love is very important to me, and I'm still struggling with it because, so, you know, after Montgomery, I got very discouraged, you know, because I kept thinking, wow, we're so hated, this hatred for color of skin is so deep and so grim that it is going to take generations to eradicate. But I'm very hopeful in my children and my grandchildren, as I said, who can manifest this love for, you know, each other and humanity that Baha'u'llah has promised us. So,
thank you so much, Cynthia. I mean, you know, I think that's the key, is that hope rooted in a faith in, you know, in Baha'u'llah's revelation, you know, to carry us through over those difficult waters, as they say, like a bridge over troubled water, right?
Exactly. Absolutely.
Well, I tell you, this has been a wonderful discussion. You know, knowing you as a friend and also as a colleague, I want to thank you so much again for sharing yourself. Thank you for the work that you do, your commitment, and your continuing, ongoing, audacious dedication to healing America's most vital and challenging issue. Thank you, Cynthia Barnes-Slater.
Okay, thank you much, Steve.
This, you've been listening to America's Most Challenging Issue. I'm your host, Masoud Olufani. And remember, world citizenship begins with an acceptance of the oneness of the human family and the interconnectedness of the nations of the earth, our home. While it encourages a sane and legitimate patriotism, it also insists upon a wider loyalty, the love of humanity as a whole. From the Baha'i Writings, thank you so much for joining us. Until next time.